Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The news release from Dublin, Ireland begins like this. One of the most intriguing problems in theoretical physics has been solved by Professor Stephen Hawking. The professor himself explained it to fellow scientists this way.
A lot of people therefore wanted to believe that information could escape from a black hole, but they didn't know how it could get out. I have been thinking about this problem for 30 years, and I now have an answer to it.
This hour, we will try to make sense of the latest thinking, the way that information can escape from a black hole, and why that matters. But fear not, fellow travelers of the D-minus in high school physics, we're not leaving you behind. We'll do a little black hole 101 before we climb up to the very mouth, the event horizon, the lip of the black hole, and peer inside. Hawking's announcement seems to indicate that the black hole, well, might not be as frightening a vortex as originally thought, that it might not be the light-sucking, star-eating stuff of cosmic nightmares after all. Does that make the black hole any easier to understand? Are you in any way relieved to hear that nothing really disappears into a black hole forever? Or was that mystery your whole fascination with them? Do you still cling on to the notion that black holes are portals to a parallel universe? Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you wish to connect with us using earthly means. 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting today with Professor Andrew Strominger. He is a professor of physics at Harvard University here with me in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hello.
Is this really a big deal for everybody's understanding of what's out there, or is this just something within the world of theoretical physics?
Well, the issue of what happens with black holes and what happens to the information that goes into black holes is a huge deal. Hawking raised a fundamental paradox in his beautiful and seminal work 30 years ago, and we need to solve this problem because in his work 30 years ago, he showed that the laws of quantum mechanics and the laws, Einstein's laws of general relativity, were incompatible. They contradicted one another. And so that's a big deal for us, and that's a big deal for the way that we think about the universe that we live in. This discussion about Hawking's paradox has been going on for 30 years, and recently Hawking has come up with an interesting new angle on it, which he announced at Dublin, and we have yet to see how this fully fits in with the rest of the things that we understand about black holes and the information paradox.
And in the whole universe of black holes, I'm using the small u universe here,
yeah.
I mean, it's not all Stephen Hawking. I mean, there are thousands now of theoretical physicists who are doing groundbreaking work here. It's interesting because he's such a rock star terms of name recognition, but it's, I mean, is his adjustment of his original theory an adjustment for everybody?
Well, yes, there have been many people working on black holes. They've been around, they've been understood to exist since Einstein's time nearly a century ago. But he's not just a rock star. He's a brilliant mind, and he's made some really deep contributions to the field. But now we're trying to understand this, and we'll have to see how it fits in and see if the details mesh out.
You know Hawking. You've met him. You've worked with him.
Yes, I know. I know him. We've worked together, and we've argued a lot.
Was it a big deal for him to say, "I changed my mind"?
Oh yes, he's a very stubborn man. He's a very stubborn man, and it was a big deal, but it seemed to be coming.
I want to hear from Lynn Kaminsky for a couple of minutes here. Lynn's joining us on the phone from Petaluma, California. She works as head of the Education and Public Outreach Program for NASA's Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope mission. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Is this big news for the people who are at the small end of the telescope lens as well?
I think people are always fascinated by whatever Hawking has to say. And I do think in the public's mind he is sort of the rock star of physics at the present time. But I think it's very hard for the general public to understand the real import of his latest theories.
We're going to fix that completely on this program. Lynn, tell me in your working with the public, though, why it is that black holes are such candy for the imagination.
We have done studies to see what types of things people are interested in learning about in outer space. And after aliens, black holes are the big number two. So since we have no evidence for aliens and we have lots of evidence for black holes, I think they are the most fascinating object out there that we regularly receive data from and that people can learn more and study.
But people still drag around some pretty strange misconceptions about the black hole?
Oh, there are many misconceptions about black holes, and most of them are propagated by science fiction movies and
right.
Star Trek and all of the different things that you see in the public media in which people are going through a black hole and coming out into another universe and things like that. Now, until recently, there was at least some small amount of theoretical ground that might be possible under very exotic conditions that nobody knew how to create. Now what Hawking has said is that doesn't really ever appear to be possible.
Okay, I'm putting the two of you to work here. Andrew, I'm going to start with you. If you were to try and explain to someone who'd never thought about this before what a black hole is, how do you do that? What's the simplest way of explaining it?
Well, a black hole is a region in space where matter has become so concentrated, the gravitational field so strong, that nothing can escape from it, even light. So even the light which might come out of a black hole falls back into it due to the gravitational pull.
Is it an object or is it the lack of an object, though, if you're actually trying to see something up there?
It's an object.
Paused on that one.
Well, it's a little bit of a metaphysical question, but you could think of it as a hole in space.
And Lynn, what do you see when you take one of those super-duper high-powered telescopes and focus it on what's thought to be a black hole?
We don't have the resolution at the present time, even with visible light, to see all the way down to the event horizon of a black hole. For example, the most spectacular pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope can only get you within a few hundred times the radius of the event horizon, and it's within this event horizon that the light can't escape. A lot of people believe that light can never escape from a black hole, but that's only true if you get too close.
An event horizon.
The
event horizon that you're describing, that's the fat end, that's the mouth, right? That's the lip?
That's certainly what people would usually call the mouth if they're thinking of it as gobbling things up, sure.
am I going down the wrong path already, Andrew, by trying to sort of create a mental image of a black hole in my mind?
Well, it's hard to, the event horizon is the surface of the black hole.
Okay.
And you might say that the black hole is what's inside the event horizon. And nothing, not even light, can escape from inside the event horizon. So no matter how good a telescope you had, you would never actually be able to see a black hole, because seeing a black hole means that you would see light coming out of the black hole.
Right.
And so by definition, they're black. You can't see them. But what you can see is things that go very near the black hole and how their motion in space is affected by the presence of the black hole. And by looking at things just around the black hole, Professor Kaminsky mentioned 100 times the radius of the black hole. They've
right.
been able to look at objects and see how they behave and infer that there must be a black hole there. But you will never actually see it, because no light will come out of it, and seeing involves light.
And Lynn, help me with your explanation of why it matters to us Earthlings what goes on in and around a black hole. Does it have an effect? Could it have an effect on us or the way that we understand our place here?
It doesn't have much direct effect on our daily lives. But for people who are trying to understand the universe and how the universe came to be and what our place is in the universe, I think black holes will always be extremely fascinating. They are the most exotic objects out there. There'll always be a big mystery about what's going on inside that event horizon, and I think that's part of the fascination to the general public.
Is it always going to be theory, Andrew? Or is somebody at some point going to be able to say, I can prove it?
Absolutely. It's absolutely not always going to be theory. I mean, certainly NASA has and various astronomical observations have given very strong evidence, if not proof, that there are black holes out there. As far as understanding their theoretical properties, we don't understand them now. I mean, you said that the general public has a lot of misconceptions and confusions about what a black hole is.
I'm one of them. But
well, I'll let you in on a secret. I'm confused, too. I teach a course on black holes, and I don't really understand what a black hole is.
Oh, that's
I don't
so think, good to hear.
I don't think anybody does. And even Stephen Hawking changed his mind yesterday after 30 years. So they are enigmatic objects. We've been trying to understand them for a century. They're full of deep mysteries. And I think that by thinking about black holes, they're going to be a window, maybe not into another universe. There have been speculations about that, but maybe not a window into another universe, but a window into understanding the deep mysteries of our own universe.
Is that why, when Stephen Hawking talks about the possibility of information coming back out of a black hole, they then perhaps become more, I was going to say useful, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but more interesting because they allow us to place them in space and time as well. You know what I'm saying? If they don't gobble everything and it disappears forever and ever, then there is some value in understanding what comes back out?
Well, we'd like to know. It's a very fundamental question about the nature of our universe, whether information can be lost permanently or not. So if you have a diary and you never want your mother to read it, you can tear it up and put it in the trash can and throw the trash can in the sun, but someone who's very persistent might be able to go and piece together the pieces and get the information back out. But if there are black holes in the universe, you can throw your diary in a black hole, and the black hole will, according to Hawking's great discovery 3 decades ago, the black hole will evaporate, and the diary and the information about what was in it will be gone forever and could never be recovered. And that's a lot to swallow. And that's what Hawking argued 30 years ago. And he gave a very simple and breathtakingly elegant argument that this should be the case, that rested on just a few assumptions. But it was the final conclusion was very difficult to swallow. And a lot of people didn't swallow it. And there's been a lot of doubt about whether the final conclusion was correct. But even though there's been a lot of doubt, nobody has really pinpointed what the error might be in his original argument. And what Hawking did yesterday was not to say, okay, in line 63 of my paper,
I put in a minus sign when there should have been a plus.
When there should have been a plus sign, he approached it from another point of view and came up with a different conclusion.
We have to take a short break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Are you getting any closer to an understanding of the black hole? If you're not, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We invite you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me this hour, Lynn Kaminsky. She's a professor at the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Sonoma State University and works with NASA's Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. She's on the phone from Petaluma, California. Here in The Connection studio, Andrew Strominger. He is a professor of physics at Harvard University and one of those focusing on string theory to solve the puzzle that black holes pose to the laws of physics and quantum mechanics. No quantum mechanics required to call us at 1-800-423-8255. We'd love to have you join us. We're going to start in Worcester, Massachusetts, and Alex is with us. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Thank you for your show, and thank you to your guests. Two inconsistencies. 20 years ago, I was associated with Livermore Labs, and there were two things that were kind of unusual. One is that all the images, you know, I remember people just discussing all the graphic image supposedly, you know, done by artists of black holes.
Mm-hmm.
Various people said, no, they're all wrong. It's not a black hole unless it's all by itself and naked. It's surrounded by all this trash of matter that's left around, and that makes it essentially look like an incredibly brilliant star. So if you were, let's say, 10 times the event horizon away from a black hole, and you could somehow survive the gravitational tide effect, you wouldn't see a black hole. You'd see an awfully bright light.
Well, all that trash wouldn't be pulled into the black hole, Alex?
It's all the stuff that's still not fully pulled in yet. And, if it's by itself, way out, somewhere way beyond the galaxy, okay. But, of course, how in the world did it get to be a naked black hole by itself? But if it's somewhere in the realm of other matter, it's going to be trying to suck that stuff in, but with its gravitational field.
Okay, hang on to that one, Alex. I want to take these one at a time, or I'll get lost, and that's a horrible thing. Lynn, do you want to just start with the visual part of this?
Okay, well, that's exactly what we see when we look out into space and claim that we've found evidence for black holes. We see the glowing disks of gas and dust that surround these massive and supermassive black holes in the cores of the galaxies. Now, our galaxy does not have a particularly bright black hole, but we can actually see little stars whizzing around it. When we look at distant galaxies, especially galaxies that we call active galaxies, we can see very bright sources of all types of radiation, visible light all the way through gamma rays, and that's, in fact, what the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope is going to be surveying. We already know of about 70 such supermassive black holes in the cores of distant galaxies that we see as very bright points of light, and especially gamma ray light.
Can you, for those of us who are trying to follow here, just explain the difference between seeing something through that telescope that is a bright light and identifying it as a black hole, as opposed to seeing something through the telescope that's a bright light and saying, oh, well, that's a star?
It depends on which telescopes you're using, and it also depends on what type of light you're seeing, and it depends on various physical characteristics of the light. The most direct measurements that we have of black holes are of the ones that are only a few times as massive as our sun and that reside in our own galaxy, the so-called stellar mass black holes. Now, we can measure them very accurately because they're typically in binary systems with a regular star that is like our sun, or a bit smaller or a bit larger.
Alex, I want to go back to Alex here. You had a second quick question, Alex?
Right, yeah. By the way, it looks like the artists are wrong on that one, including me. I used to draw pictures of these things. The other thing was just something I overheard. About 20 years ago, people were working with, I suspect it was for a weapon or system, something called a self-focusing laser. The center of the beam is brighter than the edge of the beam. And energy and mass being the same thing, the beam itself acts like a lens. It focuses itself down finer and finer and finer. And what they were able to notice were flickers. At certain points, the beam would actually focus itself down to catastrophe. And you'd actually get atomic radiation from that point, and the beam of light would actually stop. And someone said, this is proof that it's not that a black hole is not a hole to another universe, but is actually all within the same universe. And what is happening is that since it's so small, it's essentially evaporating.
Or that there's black holes all around us that we're not using telescopes to see, perhaps.
Or they're very, very, very tiny. But the interesting part to me was...
Hang on, Alex. Let me just get Andrew to join us on this one.
Well, I don't know about that experiment, but certainly it would be incredibly important were someone able to, make a black hole which existed momentarily and then evaporated.
Do people have people try to recreate that?
I think it's very, very difficult.
My favorite.
I know there was some worry, for example, that the big particle accelerator detector at Brookhaven that's doing an experiment colliding gold nuclei might temporarily create little mini black holes, a la one of Hawking's earlier suggestions.
But they'd have to be microscopic, would they not?
Right. Well, that's what they were worried about, creating these little tiny seed black holes, similar to the kind that at one point people thought might have existed at the beginning of the universe. But there's still no evidence for black holes that are any smaller than, say, 10 times the mass of our sun.
My favorite explanation of how to understand just how concentrated matter can get in the creation of a black hole is that if, now tell me if I'm getting this wrong, Andrew, that if you turned our planet as we know it into a black hole, the event horizon, that opening would be like half an inch across. Is that somebody's notion, or is that a reasonable way of looking at just how small something
yes.
would be?
Yes, yes, very, very small.
Well, for any mass object, you can calculate what the size of the event horizon would be. For our sun, for example, it's 3 kilometers. So, you know, shrink that by a million for the Earth, and you get pretty small event horizon. Mm.
All right. Alex, I want to thank you for your call and a reminder to our listeners this hour, a chance to talk about just exactly what black holes are and what Hawking's announcement meant. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up next here on WBUR, live coverage of the official public release of the 9/11 Commission report, hosted by Scott Simon. 81 degrees in Boston right now, the time is 11:29.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Pegasystems, offering business process management through rules-based software, BPM solutions for mission-critical applications, online at pega.com/WBUR, and Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
WBUR is your ticket to the Democratic National Convention.
I am determined that we reach out across party lines, and John Edwards will join me in doing that.
Bringing you in-depth news and analysis.
On this issue of experience, either side will spin it either way.
The question is there actually a message? That's the sort of criticism that's been raised.
Complete convention coverage from start to finish on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., I'm Scott Simon with a special report. The National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, also known as the 9/11 Commission, will present its report in just a few moments. The commission has called a press conference for 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time in the Mellon Auditorium on Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C. The commission has been working for well over a year now to try to provide a detailed recounting of the events and policies leading up to and including the attacks of September 11, 2001, and to forward recommendations to help prevent future terrorist attacks. The report apparently is a little bit more than 560 pages long. Beginning today, it will be available on the Commission's website. It will also be available for sale in the government printing office and many bookstores. We're told the purchase price is $10. Former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane heads the commission. He will make the opening remarks, followed by former Congressman Lee Hamilton of Indiana, who was the commission's vice chair. The floor will then be open for questions from all 10 commissioners. NPR's intelligence correspondent, Mary Louise Kelly, joins us in our studios. Mary Louise, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Scott.
And the two phrases that I think a lot of people have perhaps circled already on the basis of preliminary reports are shocked but not surprised, the reaction they say that the American people might have been expected to have to the attacks of September 11th, and also that there was a failure of imagination.
That's the way that they characterize it as their sort of overall finding, yes. It says the most important failure was one of imagination. We do not believe leaders understood the gravity of the threat. So the commission trying to be very careful here in terms of not placing blame one place or the other.
Governor Kane and Congressman Hamilton are at the podium.
The United States Congress and the American people. This report represents the unanimous conclusion of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States. On September 11, 2001, 19 men armed with knives, box cutters, mace, and pepper spray penetrated the defenses of the most powerful nation in the world. They inflicted unbearable trauma on our people, and at the same time, they turned the international order upside down. At this point, we would like to ask you to remember for a moment how you felt that day. The grief, the enormous sense of loss, but remember also how we came together that day as a nation. Young and old, rich and poor, didn't matter whether you were a Republican or a Democrat. We had a deep sense of hurt, but out of that came a deep sense of purpose. We knew what we had to do as a nation to respond, and we did. But it's also fair to say that on that September day, we were unprepared. We did not grasp the magnitude of a threat that had been gathering over a considerable period of time. As we detail in our report, this was a failure of policy, management, capability, and above all, a failure of imagination. Now, we recognize, as commissioners, that we have the benefit of hindsight. And since the plotters were flexible and resourceful, we cannot know whether any single step or series of steps would have defeated them. What we can say with a good deal of confidence is that none of the measures adopted by the United States government before 9/11 disturbed or even delayed the progress of the al-Qaeda plot. There were several unexploited opportunities. Our government did not watch list future hijackers, Hazmi and Midhoff, before they arrived in the United States, or take adequate steps to find them once they were here. Our government did not link the arrest of Zakarias Moussaoui, described as interested in flight training for the purpose of using an airplane as a terrorist act, to the heightened indications of attack. Our government did not discover false statements on visa applications or recognize passports that were manipulated in a fraudulent manner. Our government did not expand no-fly lists to include names from terrorist watch lists or require airline passengers to be more thoroughly screened. These examples make up part of a broader national security picture where the government failed to protect the American people. The United States government was simply not active enough in combating the terrorist threat before 9/11. Our diplomacy and foreign policy failed to extract bin Laden from his Afghan sanctuary. Our military forces and covert action capabilities did not have the options on the table to defeat al-Qaeda or kill or capture either bin Laden or his top lieutenants. Our intelligence and law enforcement agencies did not manage or share information or effectively follow leads to keep pace with a very nimble enemy. Our border, immigration, and aviation security agencies were not integrated into the counterterrorism effort. And much of our response on the day of 9/11 was improvised and ineffective, even as extraordinary individual acts of heroism saved countless lives. Our failures took place over many years and administrations. There's no single individual who is responsible for our failures. Yet individuals and institutions cannot be absolved of responsibility. Any person in a senior position within our government during this time bears some element of responsibility for our government's actions. Having said that, it is not our purpose to assign blame. As we said at the outset, we look back so that we can look forward. Our goal is to prevent future attacks. Every expert with whom we spoke told us an attack of even greater magnitude is now possible and even probable. We do not have the luxury of time. We must prepare, and we must act. The al-Qaeda network and its affiliates are sophisticated, patient, disciplined, and lethal. Osama bin Laden built an infrastructure and organization that was able to attract, train, and use recruits against even more ambitious targets. He rallied new zealots with each demonstration of al-Qaeda's capability. His message and his hate-filled ideology have instructed and inspired untold recruits and imitators. He and al-Qaeda despise America and its policies. They exploit political grievances and hopelessnesses within the Arab and Islamic world. They indoctrinate the disaffected and pervert one of the great world's great religions. And they seek creative methods to kill Americans in limitless numbers, including, if they can do it, with the use of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Put simply, the United States is faced with one of the greatest security challenges in our long history. We have struck blows against the terrorists since 9/11. We have, we believe, prevented attacks on the homeland. We do believe we are safer today than we were on 9/11, but we are not safe. Because al-Qaeda represents an ideology, not a finite group of people, we should not expect the danger to recede greatly as years to come. No matter whom we kill or capture, including Osama bin Laden himself, there will be still those who plot against us. Bin Laden has inspired affiliates and imitators. The societies they prey on are vulnerable. The terrorist ideology is potent, and the means for inflicting harm are readily available. We cannot let our guard down. Congressman Hamilton.
Former Congressman Lee Hamilton.
Before continuing our narrative, may I simply rise to a point of personal privilege to say what remarkable leadership we have had from the chairman of this commission. One of these days, I'm going to create a public servant hall of fame, Tom, and you're going to go in on the first ballot, I assure you. And we've had remarkable support from a dedicated group of commissioners and a highly talented staff headed by Dr. Zellico and Chris Kojum and Dan Marcus and others. And we are deeply indebted to them, as Tom will say again in a few minutes. I begin with the recommendations. This commission, of course, does not have all of the answers, but we have thought about what to do, a global strategy, and how to do it, a different way of organizing our government. But based on our thorough review of the government's performance and our examination of the progress in place of persecution, life instead of death, this message should be matched by policies that encourage and support the majority of Muslims who share these goals. At home, we need to set clear priorities for the protection of our infrastructure and the security of our transportation. Resources should be allocated based upon those priorities, and standards of preparedness should be set. The private sector and local governments should play an important part in this process. We need secure borders with heightened and uniform standards of identification for those entering and exiting the country, and an immigration system able to be efficient, allowing good people in while keeping the terrorists out. If, God forbid, there is another attack, we must be ready to respond. We must educate the public, train and equip our first responders, and anticipate countless scenarios. We recommend significant changes in the organization of government. We know that the quality of the people is more important than the quality of the wiring diagrams. Good people can overcome bad structures. They should not have to. Day and night, dedicated public servants are waging the struggle to combat terrorists and protect the homeland. We need to ensure that our government maximizes their efforts through information sharing, coordinated effort, and clear authority. A critical theme that emerged throughout our inquiry was the difficulty of answering the question, who is in charge?
Who ensures that agencies pool resources, avoid duplication, and plan jointly? Who oversees the massive integration and unity of effort necessary to keep America safe? Too often, the answer is no one. Thus, we are recommending a National Counterterrorism Center. We need effective unity of effort on counterterrorism. We should create a National Counterterrorism Center to unify all counterterrorism intelligence and operations across the foreign and the domestic divide in one organization. Right now, these efforts are too diffuse across the government. They need to be unified. We recommend a National Intelligence Director. We need unity of effort in the intelligence community. We need a much stronger head of the intelligence community and an intelligence community that organizes itself to do joint work in national mission centers. We need reforms of the kind the military had two decades ago. We need a Goldwater-Nichols reform for the intelligence community. The intelligence community needs a shift in mindset and organization so that intelligence agencies operate under the principle of joint command, with information sharing as the norm. We need reform in the United States Congress. We need unity of effort in the Congress. Right now, authority and responsibility are too diffuse. The intelligence committees do not have enough power to perform effectively their oversight work. Oversight for homeland security is splintered among too many committees. We need much stronger committees performing oversight of intelligence. And we need a single committee in each chamber providing oversight of the Department of Homeland Security. We need reform in the FBI. We need a stronger national security workforce within the FBI. We do not support the creation of a new domestic intelligence agency. What the FBI needs is a specialized and integrated national security workforce consisting of agents, analysts, linguists, and surveillance specialists. These specialists need to be recruited, trained, rewarded, and retained to ensure the development of an institutional culture with deep expertise in intelligence and national security. We need changes in information sharing. We need unity of effort in that task. The United States government has access to vast amounts of information, but it has a weak system of processing and using that information. Need to share must replace need to know. And we need a better process for transitions between one administration and another for national security officials, so that this nation does not lower its guard every 4 or 8 years. These and other recommendations are spelled out in great detail in our report. We have made a limited number of recommendations, focusing on the areas we believe most critical. We are acutely sensitive to the need to vigorously protect our liberties as we secure and guard our security. We endorse many of the actions taken in the wake of 9/11 to facilitate government action and information sharing. But we stress that these measures need to be accompanied by commitment to our open society and the principle of review. Safeguards that are built into the process and accompanied by vigorous oversight. We must, after all is said and done, preserve the liberties that we are fighting for.
Thank you, Congressman Hamilton, one of the most decent and thoughtful
Chairman Kane again.
I've ever had the pleasure to know. Before we close, we offer just a few more thoughts. We approached our task with a deep respect for the place of September 11th in our nation's history. We have compared the shock, some have compared the shock we felt to Pearl Harbor, others to the Kennedy assassination. There are no comparisons. This was a moment unique in its horror in our long history. As in every 4 years in this democracy, we are in the midst of a presidential campaign. Our two great parties will disagree, and that is right, and that is proper. At the same time, on this subject, we must unite to make our country safer. Republicans and Democrats must unite in this cause. The American people must be prepared for a long and difficult struggle. We face a determined enemy who sees this as a war of attrition, indeed as an epical struggle. We expect further attacks. Against such an enemy, there can be no complacency. This is the challenge of our generation. As Americans, we must step forward and we must meet that challenge. We have reviewed as a commission 2.5 million pages of documents. We've interviewed over 1,200 individuals, including experts and officials past and present. Our work has been assisted by a superb staff. Each one of these professionals has provided dedication and expertise that has often exceeded our very highest expectations. And we also had the honor of working with an extraordinary group of Americans, our commissioners. Each has shown skill, determination, and collegiality. We close, most importantly, by thanking the families who lost loved ones on 9/11. You demanded the creation of this commission. You have encouraged us every step of the way as partners and as witnesses. From your grief, you have drawn strength. You have given that strength to us. And we are determined, as you instructed us, to do everything possible to prevent other families from ever suffering such a tragedy again. On that beautiful September day, we felt great hurt, but we believed and we acted as one nation. We united as Americans have always united in the face of any common foe. Five Republicans and five Democrats have come together today with that same unity of purpose. We file no additional views in this report. We have no dissents. We have each decided that we will play no active role in the fall presidential campaign. We will instead devote our time, as we have, to work together in support of the recommendations in this report. You see, we believe that acting together as Republicans and Democrats, we can make a difference. We can make our nation safer. We can make our nation more secure. We'd be happy to take your questions.
Commission Chairman, former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane. Questions now.
Why was it that you decided as a commission not to say whether the attacks could have been prevented or not prevented, given all the information that you have accumulated over the 20 months?
Excuse me, I didn't hear the beginning of the question. It's coming out now. I think the microphone didn't work well. Could you repeat the question?
Why was there no determination about whether the attacks could have been prevented or not prevented, given all of the information that you have accumulated over the past 20 months?
What we did is present the facts as we learned them. As you look at these facts, time after time, you will find, as we detailed, people who got in to this country who should not have gotten in, because their travel documents didn't earn that distinction. We document intelligence agencies who didn't share information. We document actions by the government that should have been taken and were not taken. But you've asked, would any single one of these things, or even in combination, are we sure that if they had occurred in a different way, that 9/11 would have prevented? I can't say we are sure. We do not know. We think it's possible. But we have not drawn that absolute conclusion because we don't believe that absolute conclusion is justified by the facts.
Hi, John Diamond, USA Today. Going through the report, the findings seem to focus on a whole array of problems. The proposals for solution are focused narrowly in structural solutions, changes in the shape of government. The families are already being quoted today as saying that they view this as very, very important. Their next step will be to see that these are implemented. I'm wondering if there's any concern that it's kind of a false promise, the idea that if the structure is fixed, that, as you say, Mr. Chairman, that there will not be or may not be another attack such as this, that structural reform is the answer to preventing another 9/11.
I think the report is much broader than your question might suggest. You are correct that an important part of the report focuses on organizational change in the executive branch and in the Congress. And in my remarks a moment ago, I emphasized those. But in the complete report, we recognize the necessity of doing a number of things to attack the terrorists, to deny them sanctuaries, to provide stability and security in the key countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. We have a section in the report on the trying to prevent the growth of terrorism. And this is a very formidable challenge, as all of you can appreciate, because what it means is we have to engage in ideas with the Muslim world. We have to develop American policies that we understand the consequences of. We need to put together all of the elements of a counterterrorism strategy, which I identified, I think, a little earlier. And we recommend a number of steps.